This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, this week we have a first-time guest on the program, someone whom we should have talked to well before now. She is Erin McDonough, and she is the Executive Director of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs, commonly known as MUCC. MUCC has a long and honored tradition of conservation in Michigan, and it's good to meet you, Erin, and sorry we didn't have you on the show sooner.
Well, thank you for having me today. Excited to be here.
For our listeners now, most of our listeners have heard of MUCC. You've been around for a long time, but a little bit about what you do at Michigan United Conservation Clubs.
Sure. Well, the MUCC just celebrated a 75th anniversary, so we're very proud of that. We are in the business of uniting citizens to conserve, protect, and enhance our natural resources and outdoor heritage. We do that through a variety of different ways. We do a lot of communication, a lot of education, both adult and youth, and a lot of advocacy, both at the state capitol and at the federal level. And, you know, we really want to protect people's rights to hunt, fish, and trap. We want to engage people in advocacy and science-based management, and we want to help people foster a stewardship ethic.
Well, we like to talk about people in agriculture as original conservationists, but certainly people in hunting and fishing and trapping are also original conservationists. They have been since time immemorial.
If you look back 75 years ago, you will see a lot of innovative conservation initiatives that were brought on by sportsmen and women. I mean, 75 years ago, we had a lot of pollution. We didn't have sustainable mechanisms for protecting our fish, wildlife, forests. I mean, 75 years ago was the anniversary of Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson. Most people don't realize that when you buy firearm, you buy a hunting license, you buy a fishing license, you buy a fishing pole, all of that money goes to support the habitat, the fisheries, and the perpetuation, the sustainability of those systems. And that was initiated by sportsmen and still supported today.
You're into conservation, you say, mm-hmm. not preservation. What's the
Correct.
Difference?
So conservation is about the wise use of our natural resources. We firmly believe that you can have a strong economy and a strong environment, and that where the two meet is where you have conservation. So you'll see us looking for common sense solutions, and you'll see us continually looking for that balance throughout all of our natural resources decisions.
Well, speaking of the, and this, I couldn't have provided a better lead in this interface between conservation and economy, or between the environment and economy leading to conservation. Governor Snyder just released his statement on energy and the environment. And I know, Erin, you were involved in some of that, particularly on the environmental side. A little bit about that process, and then talk specifically where MUCC had input into his statement.
Sure. Well, the governor had a specific section which talked about all of the different land-based initiatives that were going on in the state. So he referenced the Blue Ribbon Panel on State Parks and Outdoor Recreation. He referenced this new land management plan. He referenced this trails plan. And so MUCC is really engaged in all of those areas. I was a co-chair on the Blue Ribbon Parks panel. I sit on the Michigan Snowmobile and Trails Advisory Council, and we're currently ramping up to work on this land management plan. And a lot of people say, okay, well, so, you know, you are an umbrella for hunters, anglers, and trappers, but also conservationists. So why are you engaged in all these things? Well, our lands are multi-purpose, multi-use. Our members like to do a lot of those same things. They care about the parks. We have a lot of policy on parks. Our members are trail users. Our members are interested in the long-term perpetuation of our public lands for access reasons and for, you know, making sure that we have sustainable wildlife and fisheries populations. So you can't just take parks and think, oh, well, only people that want to, that it's an isolated thing. So we've been firmly engaged in all of those plans. The Blue Ribbon Panel for Parks, for State Parks, was the first one that is finished. We submitted that to the governor back in October. And part of what really excites me about that plan is we spent a year going out and researching all different types of innovations that were going on. We looked at the dynamic between people and lands. We looked at rural. We looked at urban. We traveled around the state from Detroit to visit the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. We traveled to Alpena to look at the NOAA Sanctuary. I mean, to Quammenon Falls. We were up there. And it was so telling how integral so many of these parks are to those local economies and how they can also be drivers with the appropriate investment. So on the state parks front, the plan, you'll see, has some broad outcomes that we, when we look at investing our dollars in state parks and outdoor recreation, where's the best place to invest it? What kind of outcomes do we want to purchase with those investments? And so we look at things like, we looked at things like making sure that if you're investing, that it is reaping an economic benefit in those communities, that you're helping those communities define their sense of place, that you're protecting natural, cultural, historic, prehistoric resources, that you're looking at the health aspect. How do you use these lands to drive health? You know, how do you take an investment and then reap that health benefit? How do you look at them as a revitalization tool for your urban areas? And how do you look at them as a way to just connect people to nature overall? So looking at, if you look at that plan, what I'm really proud of, and I know the other members of that panel are, is that we say, here's what we want to, here's the outcomes we want to purchase if we invest our dollars in these appropriate ways, we're going to get these outcomes. And that's what we should be thinking about overall, not just in the parks plan, but in the land management plan, in the trails plan, driving towards those bigger outcomes.
You talked about a land management plan and the importance of looking at economic impact along with a lot of other things to create a holistic look at what the state owns in terms of its trails and its parks. What is this going to mean for the users of our parks and trails?
Well, I think what the users are going to see is more strategic investment. And you're going to see, so now the trails plan, which deals with snowmobiles, ORVs, hiking, biking, you know, horseback riding, it deals with the whole cadre of trails. You're going to see specific investments in connectivity, looping, linking these trails into specific communities. I mean, it is amazing and inspiring the number and the depth and breadth of organizations and people that are engaged in helping to make Michigan a trail state. And you will see, I think, a greater focus and investment in some of our targeted pots of money in creating this connectivity. So I think especially communities that are engaged in linking their towns to their trails and vice versa, you're going to see them being successful. I mean, I think the governor taking this on and pointing this out as an issue is really going to drive that. Now, the land management plan is really just getting underway. And so that was an outgrowth from legislation that was passed last year that essentially capped the amount of public land that we could own north of the Mason-Aranac line, did not cap it in the southern part of the state, recognizing that those are population centers and there's not as much public land down there. So the legislation called for the creation of this plan that is supposed to be a strategic, you know, guiding for how we use all of our state lands. I mean, currently we use our state lands for so many different things. I think a lot of people don't realize that you hunt, fish, and trap on state lands. You do all of your trails. You do a lot of your trails on state lands. You do timber harvesting on state lands. You do mining on state lands. You do camping both in the state parks, but then you have dispersed campgrounds as well. So our state lands are, we have 4.6 million acres. They are bountiful. They are beautiful. They help people really get in. They're the foundation of pure Michigan. Mm-hmm. You
Absolutely.
Know, they provide access to the waterways. So we need to make sure that in this land management plan that we're looking at all of the things that are happening on state lands and providing a comprehensive picture. Because until we know that, until we know how we're using those lands, how are we going to know how to best maximize
and
their
potential?
And it's
going to be piecemeal,
yeah,
which
exactly.
Historically it's been. I mean, I think the holistic dimension of this is really wonderful, and mm-hmm. also the underlying economic driver dimension of the plan. Those two issues or those two elements seem to make this a very progressive and far-sighted plan. Let's turn to a couple other things that MUCC is involved in. One thing that I definitely wanted to mention because it looks like a success story, and this is your mentored youth hunting program. It's no secret that we have fewer young people who are getting out of doors, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And I know MUCC has been addressing that problem for a long time. This looks like one way to do that.
Yeah, this was a real exciting piece of legislation for us. And what it did essentially is it removed the youth hunting age, and it allows parents to decide when their children are ready to go out into the outdoors. And we have we also revamped the youth license system so that it makes it easier for youth to be able to, you know, purchase a hunting license and contribute back to conservation like we talked about earlier. And we have seen just a tremendous outgrowth of people taking their kids turkey hunting that haven't done it before, small game hunting. When you look at conservation across the decades, people got engaged primarily through small game hunting, and they got engaged much younger than our traditional system allowed them to. So by removing this barrier, we've allowed children to have entry into the traditional ways that they used to with all kinds of hunting, but we've seen this outgrowth and people just writing in about how what a great time their kids have had, how inspiring it is, how when you get them that young engaged, you're going to have them engaged for a lifetime.
My guest is Aaron McDonough, who's the executive director of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. Now, another thing that's in the news and has been for a while is this whole youth hunting program that is in the works in Michigan. Wolves were removed from the endangered species list not too long ago, and Michigan is in the process of putting together a hunting season. Mm-hmm. Where are we with that?
So at the end of the legislative session, they passed legislation that allowed wolves to be a game animal. Now, this does not put a hunt in place in the state. In order to do a wolf hunt, the Natural Resources Commission has to go through a process that also includes a separate process with the tribes to talk through the sustainability of the population, to talk through the ways that you can do this, to talk through the best methods for doing this. And they're really looking at specific areas in the UP where there are problems and where there's a lot of human-wolf conflict, agricultural wolf conflict. And so they're looking at those specific areas. This really is a success story. I mean, we started off with a population goal in the state of 200. We're at over 700 wolves. And you'll see, like, for instance, take the elk population. When we brought the elk population back in Michigan to a huntable level, I mean, it was just a celebration story. And now we have a sustainable population of the elk. The money that comes in from those hunting tags goes back to perpetuate, making sure you have the proper habitat. And we see
back to the interface between economics and conservation.
Exactly. And we expect to see the same type of program here. Yeah. I mean, it's a tremendous story.
Now that we will have that program unless the Humane Society of the United States is successful in putting the wolf back on the endangered species list.
So at the federal level, the Humane Society has put a lawsuit in place that would request that they put the populations back on the endangered species list. There is no science that would dictate that should happen. I mean, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is not going to delist a species that's on the brink. And so this has been years in the making. The lawsuit, I think, has been introduced a couple times and, you know, was successful once on procedural. But when you look at the science, I mean, there's not really a leg to stand on in terms of making sure that, in terms of determining whether the population is sustainable or not, it is.
And that's one of the linchpins of MUCC, and you mentioned it. I was going to sort of close with that, but science-based wildlife and fish management, that's a hallmark of MUCC, mm-hmm. Science-based.
Mm-hmm. Proposal G was something that our membership put on the ballot and was passed by the people of the state of Michigan, and that said, hey, we want science to guide our resource decisions, you know, not a gut check or not an emotional response to, you know, what we think is happening out there. We have so many talented people, so many partnerships with MSU that do this research across the board for all kinds of fisheries and wildlife management. Do we should, as a state, want that to guide how we make our decisions?
You know, we've talked a bit about hunting and land management and all of that. I think in the couple minutes we have left, it'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the importance of water. And I know MUCC has been engaged in an array of water-related issues, including invasive species.
Yeah, invasive species are one of the most important issues to our membership. I mean, aquatic invasive species, land-based invasive species. You look at the Asian carp, and it is one of the biggest frustrations to our membership, because it's so clear when you look at that the ounce of prevention is worth the pound of cure in that case. When you have, if you have these Asian carp getting into the Great Lakes, you're going to see that impact in all of those river mouths, all those recreational harbors. I mean, I think you've heard people talking about this dredging issue and how big that is in terms of the economies of those recreational harbors.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's a critical issue. But now imagine that you have Asian carp in your recreational harbors, too. I mean, if you look up and down the Mississippi, those communities that have those carp are ghost towns. I mean, they're a dangerous species. And we need to look at that complete separation of the Mississippi water body from the Great Lakes, not just for the Asian carp, but because of all the other species that are moving back and forth. Every time we get one, it's costing us big bucks.
And that's been true historically. Mm-hmm. Aaron, your website is mucc.org. It's a wonderful website. I would be remiss if I didn't mention also the great publications that you've historically had, Michigan Outdoors, Affairs and other tracks magazine for young people. But for more information on the Michigan United Conservation Clubs, that's MUCC.org. My guest has been Aaron McDonough, who is the executive director of MUCC. Thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Dr. Sarah Aboud is coordinator for student programs in MSU's College of Veterinary Medicine and an assistant professor in the Small Animal Teaching Hospital. Her specialty is small animal nutrition. That mostly means dogs and cats.
And what they eat, what they're eating when they're healthy, and how I also help their owners manage problems when they're not so healthy. When they're sick in the hospital, I consult with our veterinarians here on staff and the students, and I'm teaching students about nutrition for pets.
Welcome to MSU Today, Dr. Aboud. So what are some of the issues in pet nutrition today?
One of the biggest issues in pet nutrition these days is obesity. Depending on who you read, there are anywhere from 20 to 40% of dogs and cats in the United States that are considered overweight or obese. That's a major nutrition problem. Other nutrition problems are associated typically with animals that have chronic diseases. So for conditions such as diabetes, chronic renal failure, or cancer, we have diets or management therapies that we attempt to use to help animals through the acute phase, when something's really flaring up, or the chronic phase of the disease process.
Do obese dogs tend to be owned by obese people?
There are some indirect sorts of pieces of information that we have that indicate that overweight dogs and cats tend to be owned by overweight people. So some of it is our sedentary lifestyles. Although there are lots of people who are very active, there are millions of dogs and cats, and most of them spend time indoors, especially in cold winter months, and most of their owners are exposed to a lot of easy, cheap food. You know, fast food restaurants are available for everyone, and so people's busy lifestyles, eating on the go, tend to contribute to less exercise for their pets.
So what advice do you have for pet owners who think they have an overweight dog or cat?
For a lot of the pet owners that I see who are clients of our teaching hospital, by the time they get to me, they've heard lots of advice from their own veterinarian. And so the advice is the same, but people don't always want to follow it. And it is pretty basic. You know, ingest fewer calories than you burn, or burn more calories to try to lose weight. So for our pets, what can we do? I mean, as animal owners, we're in control of the food that they eat and the exercise that they get. So we need to do simple things like use a measuring cup to portion out their food. If we're free choice feeding them, if we're filling up the food bowl, and we're not really understanding how many calories that they need, they're at more risk for obesity, especially if they're a breed of dog or cat that's more prone to obesity. And you might ask, well, what are some of those breeds? And actually, more and more, there are a lot of them, but some of the breeds are Labradors, Golden Retrievers, and Beagles. And it won't surprise you that those are some of the most popular breeds. So people have popular pets. People tend to overfeed themselves, not exercise as much. We tend to do that with our favorite pets. Those are some breeds that, over time, have become genetically predisposed to obesity. So portioning out their food, understanding for their body weight and their age and their activity level, how many calories actually do they need a day? Most owners would be very surprised to realize that their pets need very little in terms of volume of food. And that's because the pet food companies have taken all the work out of it for us. You know, so foods are very energy dense, and foods that are marketed as complete and balanced for a young growing animal or an adult have all that animal needs. We don't really need to supplement anything else. And when we come along and add in lots of commercial treats and snacks or people food right from the table or from the fridge or from the counter, we're adding calories and we don't even often know how much. So minimizing treats or choosing low-calorie, no-calorie kinds of treats is always something that pet owners can talk to their veterinarians about. And the question they should ask is, how can I feed low-calorie, no-calorie treats? What are some good recommendations? People might be surprised to know that depending on the size of the dog treat, commercial dog treats can range anywhere from 10 calories apiece to over 300 calories apiece. And if you're a dog that only weighs 20 or 40 pounds, a couple of, you know, 40 or 50 calorie treats can really add up over time. So that lends itself to this overweight or this obese condition. Cat treats, on the other hand, no matter who's making them, always tend to be in between 2 to 4 calories apiece because cats have about the same mouth structure, mouth size, and so the calorie or the kibble size of the treat, the shape of the treat, does not need to be big for a big cat versus a small cat. Measuring the food, reducing calories in the treats that people give and portioning those out, and then increasing exercise. Those are exercise or activity. Those are the three big things that folks can do to maintain a good weight in their pet. And how do you do that in the winter months? Sometimes people say, well, my dog or my cat, they've never been a big exerciser, right? So you stop thinking about it as exercise, like, oh gosh, I've got to walk the dog for half a mile out in the cold weather. You think more about it in terms of, I'm going to increase their activity. How could I do that? For animals in which I'm actually trying to help them lose a little bit of weight, I'll coach the owner on thinking about, let's put the calories in different places around the house so the animal actually has to work for their food. So stop putting it all in the bowl and making it available to them all the time. You know, if they've got stairs in the house, you can throw some up the stairs or down the stairs and let the animal go after it. Or if you're trying to teach a dog some obedience tricks or just good manners, always using a piece of their food, not an extra commercial treat, but kibble from their bowl. Use that as the treat to teach them to sit, stay, come, down, shake a paw, that kind of stuff. A little bit harder to do in cats to actually get them to exercise. So looking at all the kinds of toys that people use to keep cats stimulated is a thing that people can focus on. You know, one of the activities that people can do is go to the store or look at websites, see what things are available. Laser lights that you can flash on the wall, long fishing poles with little feathers hanging off of them. Lots of cats love those kinds of things to play.
Can you summarize all that advice then, please, Dr. Abood?
Some of the key things that owners can do to help keep their animals lean are to measure out an exact amount of food for the animal each day and pay attention to the amount of treats so that they're limited. And also pay attention to making sure that the treats that are given don't have a high number of calories. Another thing that people can do is look for ways to increase their pet's activity on a daily basis. If that's not with toys, then maybe it's just with movement. Taking animals outside on a leash to go to the bathroom, be it a dog. Some cats like to be walked if they've got a harness on as opposed to a collar around their neck. If owners don't know, then they can try to borrow a harness maybe from their veterinarian or a leash from their veterinarian, take it home for a few days, see if it'll work.
How do you know how much exercise or activity your pet needs?
We start, you know, to try to help owners nail down, well, how much does my animal need? We start with trying to figure out, first of all, for an animal of their size, what's their basic resting energy needs? And then through a thorough diet history, we find out where are all the calories coming from. And we try to match that up. And if there are way more calories than what the animal would need, and the animal's overweight, we know that we have to start with decreasing where all the calories come from. But at the same time, we ask the owner not only to keep a food diary, but we ask him to keep an exercise diary or an activity diary. And if we find out the animal's just not even getting 5 or 10 minutes of exercise or activity a day, we ask the owner to try to ramp that up by a minute or two. So typical 40 or 50 pound dogs, they should be walked on a regular basis, once or twice a day. For some people, if they have a very small space in which they can walk, that might mean walking the same space, perhaps around the yard several times. For other people who have access to a half a mile walk or a mile walk, that's reasonable. But if you find even with that kind of regular exercise on board, the animal's still not losing any weight, it's time to revisit the veterinarian and talk again about where are all the calories coming from. Should we actually change the food? Should we actually cut out commercial pet treats and move to stuff like fruits and vegetables?
Dr. Abood, what about tips for managing your pet's health and well-being in the cold weather?
Some good things that are just basic common sense when we take care of our pets in cold weather is to make sure that they're not going outside with wet paws and wet fur. And if they have been out on a walk and they're coming back in and their feet are wet, to make sure that they're dried thoroughly. Sometimes people like to put boots on their pet's paws when they go out for walks, and many veterinarians will recommend this, especially if the individual animal is prone to getting their paw pads broken open or frozen, or if they have sensitive paw pads and sensitive fur. Many dogs do really well with an outside sort of a sweater or some covering, but if they're a heavy-coated animal, they don't need that. So it's paying attention to making sure that if animals do enjoy being outside, they always have some kind of shelter. For some dogs, that might be an actual doghouse or, I want to say, a lean-to. You know, something that is partially open, partially closed, but even if there's some straw on the floor or a blanket, you know, somewhere where they could generate some warmth would be important. And then also the other thing is just the amount of time. So there's a general recommendation for people that if they're outside with their pets and they're starting to get cold, their extremities are cold, they know they need to move inside, their pets do too. If they start to shiver, their pets are probably cold. It's that same sort of common sense of like you're a parent and you have a small an infant, right? You know, what kind of blankets, what kind of exposure should you have for your infant? Well, if you're hot or you're cold, the infant should be appropriately covered too. So if I had to wrap that up, I'd say that making sure, you know, common sense wise, it's making sure that your animals are not exposed to cold elements for prolonged periods of time. Just like we would go out in the cold weather with appropriate covering, we may need to do that for dogs, especially some small dogs, be that sweaters or boots. And we want to make sure that if they're out and they're exposed to wet elements in any way, slush or rain or snow, that when they come in, they're thoroughly dried. The other thing to think about is animals that stay inside during cold weather. We often crank up the heat in our homes, and we want to make sure that cats and small dogs that like to be near heat vents and heat sources have appropriate padding so that they're not burning themselves. We want to make sure that if we're leaving home for a while, that we are turning the heat to an appropriate level. Like, it can be turned down so that your pipes don't freeze, but it doesn't have to be cranked up just for animals. I mean, they have a fur covering for a reason. So they do well with the lower heat temperatures in the house. But one other thing I want to say is, just like in the summer months, our pets, whether they're outdoors or indoors, need fresh water sources all the time. So thinking about changing a fresh water source daily, even if the pet stays indoors all the time in the winter, is an important management tool, you know, important way to take care of our pets and keep them healthy.
That's Dr. Sarah Abood, Coordinator for Student Programs in Michigan State University's College of Veterinary Medicine and an assistant professor in the Small Animal Teaching Hospital at MSU. Her specialty is small animal nutrition. For more information on the web, you can visit www.cvm.com. .msu.edu. For MSU Today, I'm Russ White.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, We're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
MSU Today is online at spartanpodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. It was a fateful day in 1975 at the Student Union at Michigan State University when Jack Epps Jr., a graduate and award-winning student filmmaker, returned to his alma mater for coffee and chili with one of his former instructors, Jim Cash. Epps had made the trek to Hollywood after graduation and had begun to make some inroads, scripting episodes of such TV series as Kojak and Hawaii Five-0. But he wanted to move to the big screen. During the course of a 40-minute conversation, Epps and Cash mapped out the skeleton plots for 10 motion pictures, of which several would actually be produced. Although Cash chose to remain living in Michigan and the duo would rarely see each other face-to-face after that meeting, through telephone and computer modem, they became a commercially and financially successful writing team. The pair teamed up on such popular 80s films as Top Gun, Legal Eagles, and The Secret of My Success.
I was a student, obviously, here at Michigan State undergraduate, and I had made some movies. And so I thought if I'm going to make movies, I should learn how to write them. So there was one screenwriting class, and I went to get into the class, and the class was filled. I couldn't get in. So I went and lobbied the professor to let me into the class, and that was Jim Cash. And he did let me in the class. And so I took the class, learned a little bit from Jim, and then we just stayed in touch. I liked his writing. He was a novelist at that time, and I was wanted to be in film. And so we just stayed in touch over a period of years, and eventually we decided to work together. And we worked long distance for 25-plus years. I was living in Los Angeles, and Jim continued to live in East Lansing.
How does the creative process work for you, Jack?
In general, creativity is something that I think you're just sort of stuck with. And it's like either you discover this part of you or you don't, but you still have it your entire life, and you find different ways to do it. And for me, it was actually by taking classes here at the university, I wrote some short stories and things as part of a GE class, American Thought and Language. And I realized I really liked it, and it satisfied a lot of the creative things I wanted to be doing. I mean, I didn't know they're creative. It's just stuff I really like to do. And so, you know, being here, the university gave me lots of opportunities to continue to pursue my creativity and taking creative writing classes, becoming an English major, literature, and just pursued it. And together, you know, I found somebody, Jim Cash, who was a great partner and a great collaborator, and we just found ways to use our different creative talents and approach to meld them together to a really lovely partnership.
What's your advice for MSU students today who want to follow in your footsteps?
Well, my advice to anybody who has a feeling that they're creative and they want to pursue the creative arts in any area is to do it. Be passionate about it, and don't listen to all the naysayers, but to basically believe in yourself and realize, one, this is a great university. You have all the opportunities to pursue any creative arts here and to do it. Two, don't be stuck just in your area. Like, I thought it was writing, and it became filmmaking, and that sort of was not what I thought it was going to be, but what it became, and that's what the university gave me, the opportunity to try to make a film. It gave me classes to try different areas, because what you think you might want to do is not maybe what your best creative talent is. But I also think you have to be brave. You have to be willing to take risks. You have to be willing to give all for your art. It has to be all passionate and encompassing, because otherwise you won't succeed.
How did MSU impact you and who you've become and continue to become, Jack Epps Jr.?
Well, you know, what's great about Michigan State is it gives you an opportunity to explore. There's so much here to discover and to just learn about. When I came here, I was a pre-med student, and it was one 8 a.m. English class in a headwind that told me I was not cut out for medicine, because if I couldn't make it to that class at 8 a.m., I surely wasn't going to make it through med school. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was pretty lost. I spent a couple years here sort of roving around, and I did find creative writing, and I like that a lot, but I was still it still was not the total passion for me. And, you know, what this university does is give you opportunities, and I think the biggest mistake a student can make is stay locked in an area and stay fixed and not take care, not explore other things, even if they know what they want to do. Broadening your life and your horizons, and Michigan State gives you that opportunity to really see all of the world in one remarkable campus.
Are there points you hope to make when you talk with students?
No. When I talk to the kids, there's no point I really want them to take away. And the reason is because everybody gets something else. And so there's nothing specifically I want to say, you must do this. What I want to do is just talk as a creative person, realize that, look, if you're creative, I'm like you, we're together, and, you know, maybe you can learn something from my journey and maybe you can't, but the most important thing is to believe in yourself. That's the hardest thing about being creative, is there's so much doubt we all have in our minds all the time. So how do you go off in a creative field in this world of doubt? That's difficult to do, and that takes faith in yourself and a willingness to take chances. And the truth is, the more chances you take, the more times you fall on your face, okay? Because that's the truth of all sort of, you know, entrepreneurial, creative sort of endeavors. But it's the people that get back up and keep doing it again and again that succeed because they have that passion and long-term commitment.
Jack, are there myths or misunderstandings most of us have about Hollywood and how it operates?
Oh, probably. You know, I've been in Hollywood Hills and I'm sitting by the pool reading scripts and calling, get PG on the phone. It's actually a job. You know, being a writer and working in the movie industry is actually having a job. And I have a very sort of 9-to-5 blue-collar approach to my work, that it's not about being hit by inspiration. It's about perspiration. You know, 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. I think that was Edison who said that. And so that's the misconception, that they think everyone's just out there in la-la land, you know, all floating in the hot tub. I have a hot tub. It's broken, but I have a hot tub. You know, so, but it's really, you know, it is dedication. Any job you do, creative or any area, you have to be dedicated to it. And it has to be something that you enjoy, because there's nothing worse than doing a field that you don't want to be doing. And if that's where you are, then you need to look for something that's going to be fulfilling to you, whether it's creative or it's just a different area of your life.
What are your thoughts on passion in one's profession, Jack?
I mean, you do have to like what – you really have to be passionate about what you're doing. You have to have a feel for it. It's something that sort of find fulfilling in some way, shape, or form. And I think there's a real sort of – society tells us we should consume and consume and consume and consume. And yet what we really want to do is do things that fulfill us. And sometimes you can't be a massive consumer when you're trying to get yourself started. So you have to realize what are most important in your life, which is you save your pennies and save your nickels and support yourself in something you love so that you can get that as your full-time job. And that's – people want it to – they want things now. And careers take time to build. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of dues. You have to pay dues right now. You know, there's a lot of internships that people have to do for long periods of time before they get hired. I don't like it, but that's the way things are, and therefore you have to be doing things you really enjoy.
Do you worry about today's young people being consumed with the new technology and social media?
I think it's a generational thing. I truly do. I think that this is who the world is, and this is who they are, and this is the life they're living. I mean, that's sort of like people saying, you know, boy, these horses are sure great. I really love my horse. And now with this iron horse, this car thing, it's not the same anymore. I don't get to put it to bed at night. And I think it really is generational. This is their world. This is the world we live in today. And it will evolve out of the way it's going to be. You know, there's always yin and yang. There's always extremes. And things will go many different directions. But, you know, we move at an incredibly fast clip. And I think it's sort of like, you know, either get on and get with it or watch it sail.
You love coming back to MSU, don't you?
You know, it's always great coming back to this campus. I mean, last night, the first thing I did was park the car, found a meter. Hard to find a parking space, I got to tell you. I found a meter and quickly grabbed it. So that's never changed, you know, parking on campus. But, you know, walking in the Commons area and Beaumont Tower and hearing the tower ring, I mean, you know, every alumni goes, you know, it just sends chills up your back. I don't know if a student, if I loved it as much, you know what I mean? You walk by and say, oh, there's that tower. But, you know, coming back here, it really is time traveling. It throws you back to, I mean, I start thinking about being a freshman. And, you know, college isn't all easy stuff. Everybody says, oh, you're college. You know, there's a lot of things that people go through. It's a period of amazing growth and development. And you start as a baby, really. You start as like this very know-nothing from high school. And you come out really with a lot of experiences, a lot of maturity. Still a hell of a lot to go. The 20s aren't easier, you know. The 20s are like, wow, boy, it's a big ball you pushed up the rock. But, you know, I love this place. I love Michigan State because of what it has given me, the opportunities, the opportunity to find myself in this very, you know, it's a large university. I came from a very small high school. I had 32 in my graduating class, okay. So coming to this university, being a large how large it was, at first was a very difficult transition. But once I realized how much was here and how much opportunity I could take and how I could explore, you realize the size is such a benefit. And I think that's what's so special here, you know. So when I think of Michigan State, I think of it as a place that just gave me lots of opportunities to find and discover myself. And I think that's one of the biggest parts of college, is not only just what do you learn, how can you apply it, what job you can get, but who am I and what do I want and how can I actualize these things and how can I be this person. And, of course, I found my wife here. We're still married. We have two kids, and that's a good thing. You know, that's a benefit.
That's Michigan State University College of Arts and Letters alumnus Jack Epps Jr., who, along with his partner and late MSU Professor Emeritus Jim Cash, were a successful Hollywood screenwriting team. For more on the college, please visit cal.msu.edu. I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. We'll have more in a moment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening, and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises
alumni.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's my conversation with noted attorney and one-time Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jeffrey Feiger.
In 2001, you donated $4 million to the MSU College of Law, which at one time was the Detroit College of Law, your alma mater, to establish the Jeffrey Feiger Trial Practice Institute at the MSU College of Law. What motivated you to do that?
I want to say altruism, but that's not entirely true. The Detroit College of Law had moved up to Michigan State, a beautiful new facility, and a couple heads better than mine had gotten together and decided that one of the things that could put Michigan State University Law School, if you will, on the map would be a trial institute in which young law students are trained in trial practice. It really has never been done in an accredited law school across the country, as incredible as that sounds. And they came to me and they said, look, you know, this is something we've been thinking about. What do you think about it? And if you like our idea, would you be interested in endowing it? And they presented me with a curriculum. They thought that my style or the method in which I've practiced and I talk about in terms of things that are necessary to be trial attorneys was a good thing to incorporate into the curriculum, like a little psychology, a little theater, which is just public speaking, really, in a varied way. And they presented it to me and said, would you be interested? And I thought about it, and I had a few million lying around, so I said, yeah.
While you're not intimately involved in the day-to-day operations, are you pleased with how it's going?
Yeah, they have me there yearly or semi-yearly for a speech, and I'm always impressed with what they've done. They tell me that it is the single biggest draw for the law school. I mean, realistically, it's a Big Ten law school now. They're putting themselves on the map. Their pass rates in terms of the bar exam are exceedingly high. Their draw from all over the country is very good. In other words, it's much less of a local or regional school and much more of a national school now. And again, they tell me the number one draw, if you will, for their law school and the number one interest that's expressed is the Trial Practice Institute, which is the first and only that I know of school of its kind, accredited law school in which second and third year law students come out of law school with a certification in trial practice, which, if that's what you're interested in, is invaluable.
What is the basic mission of your law firm?
To provide the best quality legal representation in a trial law firm. We're a personal injury firm. We only represent individuals against the corporations and against the insurance companies. I don't represent corporations. I don't represent insurance companies. And we represent people who desire attorneys who will go to trial and who won't sell them out and who aren't looking for a quick settlement and who will take the case all the way to trial if that's what needs to be done. I think we have probably, if not the physical largest, we may have the physical largest in Michigan. We certainly have the biggest in terms of the number of cases that we handle, the number of big cases.
Jeffrey Figer, one of the cornerstones of the Figer Trial Practice Institute at the MSU College of Law is the technologically advanced courtroom. Can you talk a bit about how technology has impacted the practice of law over the years?
The way it has most significantly affected the practice is access to legal research. When I started law school, the only method by which you could do legal research is to go to the books and look for the cases and shepherdize them, which is the method by which we saw if every case had ever been cited before. Today, because of the computerization of huge resources, legal research is much more effective. That would be the single biggest change. Technology in the courtroom, the idea that we can use Elmos, that we can use videos, we can use DVDs, you can store things on a computer, you know, that's all flash, smoke, and mirror. Ultimately, when I talk about the courtroom, I talk about convincing jurors, and that's what I have to do. And no amount of flash or bells, whistles, and lights is going to change that.
Jeffrey, you ran for governor of Michigan back in 1998. I mean, what motivated you to do so, and is there maybe another run for office in your future?
Probably utter stupidity. When you run for political office, you expose yourself to the cruelest of all criticisms. And it's not that I don't have a thick skin, but the type of people that can run for political office today are people who literally have been living in a closet their entire life, people who have no life, because they start looking at every aspect of your life. And look what they did to President Clinton. I mean, whether or not he had an affair, I could care less about that. And that's not an issue for me. And in essence, I think we're reaping what we sow. look who we have now in political office. We don't have the best and the brightest. We don't have people who are successful and give something back. We have people who need the job, and it's the best job they ever have, and they never want to leave it.
Jeffrey, what's your advice to law students today who maybe want to be the next Jeffrey Figer?
Don't try to be me. Just be yourself. It's the hardest thing in the world that you can do. If you think you want to be a trial lawyer, if you think you want to be the best trial lawyer who ever inhabited a courtroom, then look at yourself in the mirror and maybe lay down on a couch and have a psychologist or psychiatrist examine your head until you really understand what makes you tick, because you can't imitate me. You can't be me. You can only be yourself, and you can be the best yourself of what you are, if that makes sense at all. Be the best you possibly can.
In closing, Jeffrey, could you just summarize your feelings for the Trial Practice Institute at MSU that has your name on it, and what would you like people to know about it?
Well, I'm very proud of it. I like the fact that it trains people to do what I do. I like the fact that it's the first accredited school of its kind in the country. I like the fact that it has my name on it. And I like the fact that it's at the school which accepted me and matriculated me. So all in all, I'm very, very proud of it, and I'm happy for its success. And I hope they continue with my name after they have used up my money.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Everybody at MSU.
Jeffrey Figer, noted trial practice attorney whose name is on the Figer Trial Practice Institute at MSU's College of Law. And there's more on the web at law.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family, and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, burn it up, so you know, radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.